on, everybody, and welcome to episode 41 of the Mental Dive Podcast, where we talk anything and everything, sports psychology and mental performance. I'm your host, Taylor Staden. We all go through these moments, and we all go through these times where things aren't going our way. We've been hit with some adversity. Ultimately, we're just not getting the bounces that maybe we want to get. Perhaps we thought we'd be further along towards a certain goal. Maybe we were progressing really well and then something unexpected happened. And as much as these can be very frustrating in the moment and maybe make you want to quit, typically nothing worth achieving comes without its adversities. Comes without those hardships and comes without those times where maybe you want to quit, where maybe it's easier to just give up. And I think that's a really important message I want everybody to look at during today's podcast with Mike Zygmunis, 2009 Stanley Cup champion with the Pittsburgh Penguins. He tells a story, and we'll get into it in more detail later, but he tells a story about how he went from being put on waivers with the Phoenix Coyotes, not getting picked up, and then I'm going to leave it up to you to guess what happened after that. And if you can't guess in ample time, you'll find out later in the episode. So everybody, I am so excited to share this podcast with you all today. But without further ado, Mike Zygmunis. So today's guest is a former professional hockey player who played a total of 197 NHL games and 601 professional regular season games in both the American Hockey League and the Swedish Elite League. The Stanley Cup champion can now be found behind the bench helping coach the University of Toronto's men's ice hockey team and behind the mic on Sportsnet 590. Mike Zygmunis, how are you doing today?
Good. How are you doing?
Good.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no problem. I appreciate you joining me today. How's everything back in Toronto? I haven't been there for about a month now, so I'm starting to get a little homesick.
You know what? The snow hit the ground today for the first time.
It is.
And it's getting cold. Yeah, so it's a good time to take off. where did you say, where are you spending the last month?
So I'm in Greece right now.
Oh, nice. I'm jealous.
You're Greek yourself, aren't you?
Yeah, my parents are. Yeah.
Okay.
They're born in northern Greece. Yes, we've got Macedonian Greek family, and I have dual citizenship, Canadian and Greek. So
yeah.
Lucky I can bounce around Europe without having to go through customs and those long lines. I go through the EU lines. So
one of the
benefits. Yeah.
Oh, I'm jealous. I'm actually eligible for a UK citizenship, but I just haven't went through the process yet. So I should probably get on that once everything gets a little more normal, I guess.
For sure.
So Mike, the one way I always like to start the podcast is I'd love to get a bit of your background, your story in hockey, and what was kind of your why growing up? Why do you put up with the hits from behind and the late night practices and everything in between?
Hockey was, it was everywhere as a kid, right? Everybody played in school, whether it was foot hockey or mini sticks, everything was around that. Everybody was Leafs, were Leaf fans at the time. The days of, growing up with Gary Lehman, Wendell Clark, Doug Gilmore. So my cousin's family, immediate family played. A lot of my friends played. I was more of a soccer player growing up. I always showed more interest in that. And it was maybe a little bit of both. It would be obviously hockey during the winter, soccer during the summer. And then I started playing more summer hockey. It became a thing in the 80s, late 80s, right? Mm-hmm. Early 90s. So that was kind of what occupied most of my time. And then you get to that age where, all right, you kind of have to pick one sport. And I was told you have to kind of concentrate on one of them. And everybody was playing hockey, like I said earlier. And yeah, it was a natural progression. I never, you always talk about making it to the NHL and winning Stanley Cups, and you're playing ball hockey on the street with your friends. It's everything's game seven of a Stanley Cup final, but you don't ever, I'm not sure if you ever really believe it will happen one day. I'm not sure every kid plays to be in the NHL. There's a, you know, a lot of kids just love the game. I work with a number of different minor hockey teams in and around the GTA. And one year I worked with a girls team, and usually I try to talk about my experiences and players I play with. And I brought up, bringing former players' names up, whether it was, a Sidney Crosby, Evgeny Malkin. You know, you talk about all these great players, or you bring up McDavid, and the coaches, kind of pulled me over and said they have no idea who any of these guys are. They love the game of hockey. They don't know the women's players. They don't know the men's players. They just play for the love of the game. So, there's a lot more of that than people think. Everyone thinks they play for, the NHL or for these stars, and they would know everyone, but that's not always the case. So that was, growing up, we loved to play. My dad used to have a outdoor rink, and ball hockey was played almost every night that the weather was good. One thing leads to the next, and you end up in the OHL and getting drafted to the NHL. So, everyone says, like, where did it happen, or how did you get there? I'd say usually that minor bantam year, so the under 16, under 15 years, where you have scouts starting to come up to your, your team, your coach, and your parents. And I remember taking a recruiting trip to University of Michigan and Michigan State, and that was a huge experience and incredible to see inside. You get to go in the room at the age of 15, and they say, "Oh, you work a little bit harder, you can get here." Then the OHL comes the following year when you're, and you just turned 16, and that's the year guys get drafted, right? So it's really tough to pinpoint a year on, when did you know you wanted to do this, or hockey was in your future. And, it was just something I enjoyed and something that developed over time. And, I think that 15, 16, 17 years are the years that pro or semi-pro teams actually start to look at you in universities, and you kind of have an idea of where you're going to go in the sport.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I love that you brought up the idea of how playing hockey growing up and playing sports and, just more generally, it's not just about trying to go professional or trying to be the best. There's a lot of other benefits to you sport. I think about the percentage of players that actually end up going pro. Like, it's so minimal. So it makes you think about what other benefits do they take away from their participation? And there's so many life skills incorporated in sports. So I love how you brought that up, because it's so important.
Yeah, for sure. And getting to coach UFT and seeing different sides of it. And like you said, not many guys make it. I have this conversation a lot when I'm at UFT with guys, and there's a handful of guys that obviously have, no aspirations to go on. They're at university. They play in the OHL, or they're coming from the university south of the border in the U.S., and they just want to finish their education and play a little hockey on the side. They still enjoy it. And then the other half, you can probably either have team, maybe there's an opportunity to play in Europe after, or in the East Coast. Maybe I make a run at the AHL, maybe I can get in an NHL game. And
yeah,
we've had some great players on our team last couple of years and the years that I've been there. And definitely a lot of the guys on the teams I've coached there at UFT, can play at the pro level. Whether they make it to the NHL, it's always tough to determine, right? So, it depends what system they go into and get signed into. And there's so many factors, but guys do want to play. But at the same time, you're at university, you're getting an education. I think it's a great spot to be for a lot of them. Even if pro hockey isn't in their future, say you do make the NHL, you're going to play to what, your early 30s, if you're lucky, your mid 30s, what after, right? And I have this conversation with guys, you're in great position here at UFT, and you're learning a lot. You're learning whatever field you want to get into. And even if it's something you don't want to get into, you're learning a lot of valuable life skills. And we kind of preach that a lot with our team. It's not just about, developing good hockey players, but good people. And it's something we talk about weekly on our team. And I think that's the type of players we go after, and actually the type of players that are, reaching out to us to come to our team. They know what it's like. They know, the values, the core values that we have at UFT with Ryan Medell, who's our head coach, and Andrew Dovey, assistant coach. And we strive to instill those qualities in our players, because not only will it make them, you know, better people, but better hockey players as well.
It's really, really important too, especially at that point in your career where, you know, reality is a lot of U sport players don't go on to play in the NHL. I mean, I'm not an expert, but when I think of players, I think of like Joel Ward did, Derek Ryan. Mm-hmm. So there are some that play U sport and go on, but the majority don't. So it's really important to have that pre-retirement planning in place where you have a degree, you have something to fall back on. So if you don't go pro, you have other interests and other, you know, areas of expertise that you can fall back on.
Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, things like, you know, I talk a lot about focus, concentration. Those aren't things you just have. I think you can develop them. You have to have some kind of ambition and determination. You got to have competitive excellence, whether you're playing sports or you're in any kind of business or, you know, whatever field you want to get into after, whether you become an entrepreneur, or you want to develop a new app, or you want to work for a Fortune 500 company. I think that's really something, you know, you need, and obviously hard work. And we try to teach our players how to think, right? That's a big, something that's been lost, I think, in the last, 15, 20 years. If you talk to, I talked to a lot of coaches when I played as a kid, and I talk to coaches today, and obviously I get to coach minor hockey teams and the university. And I almost see a little bit of a shift in, when I played, we were just told what to do, and we went out and did it and learned it and figured it out on our own. Where today it's, you teach something and, a lot of players want to know exactly where they have to be. They're very detailed, right? But something like hockey or, you pick any sport you want. It's tough, right, to tell you, stand here at this point and do this at that point, right? You have to teach your players how to think on the go. So that's definitely one area, I like to concentrate on with the players. But, it's different, right? You have the I think something that's changed is back for myself, it was told what to do and you went and did it and that was it. Where now it's, we have to tell the kids what to do, but we have to tell them not only to do, how to do it, why we're doing it. There's so many more different layers to coaching that I think has changed. Mm-hmm. And as a coach, you have to adapt to the changes and the education with your players. So definitely a difference from when I was being coached to now coaching players.
Mm, yeah. So now, since we've come across the topic of coaching, you've had experience, like you said, being coached, back in the day, and now you're coaching players and you're getting a taste of a lot of these different, styles and philosophies. What would you say your coaching philosophy is? And maybe what are some of the key takeaways from your career that have influenced your coaching philosophy?
Well, I played for a lot of great NHL coaches, Paul Maurice, Peter Laviolette, Michael Therrien. Wayne Gretzky coached me for a year and a half when I was with the Coyotes. So, the best player of all time coaching me. I've had some of the best coaches that are still in the game. Laviolette's won a Stanley Cup. Paul Maurice has had a great career. Michael Therrien did great things with the Pittsburgh organization. He was there. So all a little bit different styles. Not a lot of room for error. They expected you to show up every day, no days off, work ethic, know the systems, but all different, right? They all had their own way of motivating. I think motivation's a big part of coaching. X's and O's are great, but it all comes down to motivation at the end. It's funny, I still talk to my grade 7 teacher, Mr. Rob Watson, and he'd coach me different sports, and we always text, we text weekly and we talk, and I just had a conversation about him having trouble with one of the players on a team I'm coaching, just not listening, and was told he was going to be a problem before I got there.
Right.
And It's just like, oh, any kids with problems, you know, just, you know, give them a timeout, send them off. And I don't like to do that. So learning how to, you know, relate to different players, whether they have, you know, you don't know what's happening in a kid's life or a player's life, right? So you always have to, you know, push players and be hard on them. But at the same time, really, you have to remember they're just kids, or they're just players. They're just, you know, I think players get treated as objects this time, and you lose sight because, you know, you've got 20 guys to worry about. And I imagine at the NHL level, that becomes a lot tougher, right?
Yeah.
So some of the best coaches I have can relate to players, you know, people that players from different backgrounds, or they're going through different things. You know, you might have an 18-year-old draft pick who's coming to your team. You might have a 20-year-old prospect. You might have a 26-year-old guy who's bounced around and he's become a suspect. And you might have a 30-year-old who's got a family and kids, or you might have a 40-year-old who's played for 20 years. So there's so many different things to look at. And the best coaches I've had motivate the best, keep you engaged, and push you outside your comfort zone, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of my coaches as a minor hockey player that definitely affected the way my career turned out was Dan Poliziani. And he coached me for 2 years of minor hockey before I went to the OHL, and was always pushing me outside my comfort zone. And that was a big thing, right? If you don't have a coach that's going to do that, it's really tough to grow and to become something, maybe an area you didn't think you could get to. And unless you can find those different plateaus, those different steps, it's tough to realize your full potential. So it's not for everyone. It's tough, and it's tough for the coach to push a player. It's tough for a player to accept criticism, or, you know, the where you're at, you know, that honesty is tough sometimes for the coach to tell a player. It's even tougher for a player to hear that stuff. And if you can find some way to, you know, not let your ego get in the way, I think you can, you know, I think there are coaches that are, the certain coaching styles are great for development and growth, and, you know, to find that area you might not have found on your own.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And I really like how you brought up the whole idea of having players who are at different points of their careers all coming in one team, because like you said, you might have an 18-year-old prospect or a 20-year-old prospect who may perhaps have been the best player on their team for basically their whole life. But when they get to the mm-hmm. NHL level, maybe their skating's not quite there, or there's something not quite there. So now the coach might see them fitting in a different role. And like you said, egos get involved. So it becomes this kind of like, how do you handle those situations, you know?
Yeah. So that's why. And coaching's changed a lot, right? There's no more of the, I feel like, all that old school coaching is almost all but gone. I think the Laviolettes and the Maurices, I think they've all evolved and they've changed their styles from 20 or 30 years ago to the way they coach today. If they didn't, they wouldn't be able to, I don't think they could be able to survive in, you know, today's game. But, you know, when you see them around this long, their coaching styles have always changed and grown. And that's why, you know, the guys that have coached me are still in the game, because they're some of the best of all time. And figuring out what makes each player tick is really important. And the best coaches are the best at doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I totally agree. So how about we take a bit of a step back, and you talk about how growing up, one of your dreams was, you know, you want to win a Stanley Cup, you want to make the NHL, and that came true. So a very late congratulations for myself on your Stanley Cup win.
Thanks.
What was that whole experience like for you, being on such an elite team surrounded by guys like Sidney Crosby, Evgeny Malkin, you name it? How did that season kind of go for you?
So I started off with the Coyotes, and I got sent to the minors at training camp, and not a lot of players are picked up on waivers at that time. So I go down to San Antonio, and I was only there about not even 2 days. And Pittsburgh actually traded for me, not even 2 days after I got there to the minor leagues in the AHL. Because when I got there, I was like, okay, everyone passed on me in waivers. I no one's going to pick me up. I'm here in San Antonio. Like, I was literally going out to sign a lease for my condo that next day.
Yeah.
Figured I'd be there the whole year. And then all of a sudden got a call. You've been traded to the Pittsburgh Penguins. I'm like, huh. And then I'm like, I guess I'm going to Wilkes-Barre Scranton. They're like, no, no, you got to get there by tomorrow. You're playing Thursday in the home opener. So yeah, I literally, like, I drove my car from Phoenix with all my stuff. 2 days, took me like 8 hours a day, tired. I practiced in, I got there in the morning. I actually played an exhibition game in the minor leagues that night. And then I was working out the next day. And that's when I was like going to, you know, get my condo. I already know where I wanted to live. I was there part of the year prior and got the call. So I was like, wow. So, you know, I'm going 2 days off, you know, in my car traveling all day. Then I play an exhibition game in the minors. And as fun as those are and happy I am to play in a professional hockey game at the age of, I was, 29 at the time. Usually when you've been a pro for 9 years, you don't like to play in the exhibition games in the minor league, in the AHL. You leave that to the young guys. And so it was kind of caught me off by surprise that actually was in the lineup after just getting there after 2 days of driving. So I went from that to literally the next day on the ice with that Penguins team that went to the finals the year before with Crosby, you know, Malkin, Fleury, Gonchar, I had all these superstars, right? Mm-hmm. Within one day, and the next day I'm in the home opener, and now it's just, you know, it's one of those times of your career or even your life where it's just it's like a wow moment, right? You kind of think you're at rock bottom, right? Not that the AHL's rock bottom, or, you know, I was lucky to have a pro contract and be in the minors, but, you know, I made the Carolina Hurricanes. I played, you know, over 100 games. And then all of a sudden you're in San Antonio in the AHL. And then, you know, 24 hours later, you're starting playing in, you know, in Mary Lemieux's meeting you at the room, and you walk into that dressing room getting ready to go and play. So,
yeah,
it was quite the turnaround. That year, so I played 20-something games. I had shoulder surgery. Didn't play the whole season. Ended up making it back to the playoffs, getting cleared. Didn't play in any games in the playoffs, but was there with the whole team for the whole experience and got to see what went into actually winning a Stanley Cup, and totally different than what I expected. A lot tougher. So much more goes into it than you think. And you know, it's a grind. You hear the stories, you read the stories, you watch TV, but actually being there is a lot different, right? What goes into beating four teams, best of sevens, and it was a tough year for the Penguins, a lot of injuries, and out of the playoffs at what point our head coach got fired, you know. That was interesting with a coaching change and to win the cup, and it's happened a number of times now, so maybe not so strange, but definitely one of those years where the team went through a lot, and to watch what it went through to actually win a cup and Game 7 and playing against, you know, an incredible Detroit Red Wings team and being in Joe Louis for Game 7. And I got to put my equipment on at the end and lift the cup up with all the guys that weren't playing. And I get asked, is that strange, not playing? And I've had a couple of people ask me about Steven Stamkos in Tampa, not playing at all in the playoffs, just playing the 2 minutes. So, you know, I kind of know what he's going through, right? You're with the team, but you want to be on the ice, right? You want to be in the fight. So that was tough. Watching the playoffs and watching the guys go through, because you want to be out there, right? That draw at the end of the game, you know, I want to take that, right? So
yeah.
I kind of understand what Stamkos went through and how he wanted to get back in, at least for a shift to feel kind of part of it, but did get in 20 some odd games. And you know, I think that's one thing that should be looked at, where players that come up, and even, you know, even if you play 10 games, I think those are huge 10 games for a team, even though a lot of players that have played 5 games, 10 games, 15 games don't get their name on the cup, right? And I was lucky that the general manager, Ray Shiro, and Mary Lemieux got me a ring and got my name on the cup. So that was something really nice they did.
That's awesome. You know what? I love that you brought up Steven Stamkos, because he's actually my favorite player.
Okay.
When I was younger, I met him at a hockey camp. Yep. I'm sure you probably know Skate On.
Yeah.
So I went to skate on when I was younger. Yeah. So I met Stamkos there, and he was just the nicest guy. So it was awesome because although he didn't really get to play much in the playoffs, he made the most of it when he was on the ice. So I'd say that's a win for Stammer.
Scored a goal. Yeah, it was a great shot. Yeah, great players for Markham. I know the family, and he's had a great career. I mean, now he's won just about everything, but he's had a little bit of injury trouble too, right?
Yeah.
Especially at the international tournaments, he's had a battle, some tough injuries, and this past year in the playoffs. So I was happy to see that his name's going to go in the cup, and definitely one of the greats in the game today, and future Hall of Famer. And
oh yeah,
you know, I was happy to see him win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, me too. So you mentioned how there's a lot of things that maybe the average fan does not see that go into a Stanley Cup. What are some of those things?
Well, you got to have a little bit of luck. There's, different times where a one goal or a breakaway or a save or a power play goal, you don't think much of it when you're watching on TV or you're at home. But, I could think of some of the saves that Fleury made were absolutely game changers and series changers, where if just that one goal goes in, the team doesn't get to the conference finals. The team doesn't get to the Stanley Cup finals. So you do have to have those big plays go the right way. You can play as good as you want, but if you don't have those big plays at the right time, yeah, you're not going to win. Tampa Bay had them this year, whether it was an overtime game, a big goal, Vasilevsky stand on his head, big games by Victor Hedman on defense where you don't expect a defense to score that often.
Didn't he have 10 goals?
So, yeah, he had broke the record for most goals or points by a defenseman. So he was incredible. So
yeah,
absolutely. So you need those big plays. You have to beat teams different ways. That's something I think gets overlooked. I'm a believer in that. Yeah, have to play the game. You have to play the game hard and physical, or you got to be fast. If you can do both, that's usually the makeup of Stanley Cup teams, because you can beat teams different ways. You're going to see a lot of everything. You're going to see teams of speed and skill, and you're going to see teams that really grind you out and play hard. And you saw that this year. You see it every year in the Stanley Cup playoffs. Mm. That's kind of what you'll have to go through to get to go the distance. So, but the Pittsburgh team in 09, they had that, right? Wasn't the toughest team, but if it got chippy or it did get physical, we had players that could answer the call there.
Yeah,
like obviously highly. Yeah, we had a lot of guys that weren't afraid of it, of the rough stuff. Not the toughest team to win the cup, but just a team that wouldn't shy away. So I think you need part of that as well. You got to be able to win in different ways. I think your coaching staff has to break down other teams, what, their systems and what they rely on to win. So that was, I think the coaching staff, did an excellent job in Dan Bylsma, that he came halfway through the team. And I thought he was an excellent coach and got to chat with him on the ice for, he'd come and skate with us sometimes, and just hearing his philosophy on the game and hockey and, some of the systems that he brought to the team and, I thought were great. And you need your best players being your best players. I mean, Crosby, Malkin were, by far the best two players on the ice in the playoffs. And, Fleury was, by far the best goaltender. So, when you get your big performances from your big guys, that's, you're not going to win anything without that.
Mm-hmm. What are some traits that perhaps Crosby and or Malkin have that make them so great?
Two different players. Crosby has, and you've heard this before, but it's true. He has the first center, first line superstar skill, but he has got that fourth line work ethic in him. And by that, I mean, if he didn't work hard, he'd still be a really good player. He'd still put up massive numbers, but all the international success, all the gold medals, the three cups, that comes because he just outworks players. He outworks everyone. So that's where a lot of his success comes from. A lot of players, when you get to that level, it's tough to just beat players on skill only to be one of the greats. A lot of the greats, they'll beat you with their hard work. I'm a true believer in that. There's a lot of good players with skill at the NHL level. Some guys just don't work. Either it's not their DNA, they don't know how to, they don't want to, they don't need to. It's like, I'm going to score my points. I mean, and that's just the way I want to do things. But the great playoff performers, the guys you lean on, call them your A group of players, your stars, those guys actually have to, it's inside them. They have to want to go out and do it. And, there's a lot of good players that, scored a lot of points in the playoffs. And you say, well, this guy had this many points. I was like, well, if you look at his whole career, was he one of the core players that you relied on? Like when you needed a big goal, was that the guy? And they're like, no. Yeah, see, you have supplemental player. You have those B-level players. And it's not a knock against guys. You need a supporting cast. Mm-hmm. But who do you turn to when you need a goal? Like who's your go-to guy? When you're down by two goals, who's going to be the leader in the room? And, Crosby was always that guy. Not the loudest leader, but definitely said something when it needed. And Malkin would more, he was more on the ice. He wouldn't talk a lot in the room, but I mean, if you needed a big goal or you needed to turn a game around, he would just go out and do it. He wouldn't talk about it. He would show you. So, different kind of leadership. He's had a better career than most people think by playing behind Crosby. It's very difficult. I think it's difficult to be the Robin when you got your Batman. To be that Robin and you're – I think it's difficult. The Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen comparison.
Yeah.
Once you play behind a superstar, I find it very difficult, especially for a guy like Malkin, because I think if he was on his own, away from Crosby, I think we'd see even more. I think he's great. Yeah, the skill level and his size and speed is, we've seen it when Crosby's been out of the lineup, right? How dominant has Malkin been when Crosby's been injured? But yeah, it's been crazy, right? Yeah. So I think if he was the main guy on a team, if he was the Batman, I think we'd see even a different gear from him. But I mean, he's had a great career and one of the best players to put skates on. Yeah.
Yeah. Would you, now that I think about it, we don't have to spend too much time on this, but is he the best second line center of all time?
Ooh, that's a good question.
The Oilers best? In the 80s and you think of
Messier and Gretzky. Yeah. Malkin's definitely there. It's tough to answer. Messier did it without Wayne twice too, right? Wayne left Edmonton and he won without Gretzky, and then he went to New York and won there. I think that's a huge test. If you can change teams and lead two different organizations to a win, for me, that's like the pinnacle of the sport. Like I can't imagine what that's like. Even players that went on two different teams, Pat Maroon did it in St. Louis and in Tampa, to go back to back with two different teams is, that says a lot.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So one thing I'd like to talk to you about is throughout your career, you think about at the NHL level, you have basically every resource possible available to you for the most part, you'd think. Did you ever notice that mental training was evident throughout your career? Like, was there someone to go to? Is that something you turn to at certain points in your career? Or what are your perspectives on that?
Well, we used to have sports psychologists on all of our teams, right? I got drafted by Buffalo in 99, and we used to have someone that would talk to us, not so much about the mental side, just about what was coming. So as an 18-year-old, what's it going to be like when you move on your own? And You're going to be dealing with a whole new set of problems that you never had when you were 16. And, you know, you're going to be 20 playing pro hockey. So they kind of give us a little intro on what to expect. You know, you're going to be coming of drinking age. You're going to have, you know, this is going to be thrown in your face. You're going to have bad influences. You're going to have all these different factors come in that you probably had no idea about. And they kind of introduced us to that, preparing us for when we enter pro hockey. So that was great of the Sabres organization to kind of look beyond the training and the nutrition side of things. Later in my career, it became, I'm trying to think, we used to have a sports doctor, psychologist would come in and like, it would be like a weekly thing where they would just pop their head in, right? Or every 2 weeks, and they'd make their way around. And sometimes you talk in the hallway, it wouldn't be in a formal setting. Sometimes you'd have your one-on-one in a room, but it wasn't bigger until later on in my career. So I've always said that you need to be mentally fresh to start a season. I was a guy that trained a lot, probably overtrained, and I'd always say for getting ready for training camp, if you're not mentally fresh to start your season, it doesn't matter how much training or what your diet's like, you know, what kind of condition you're in. If you don't feel mentally refreshed to start your season, you're not going to be at your best. You're not going to make the team, and you're not going to keep what you had the year before. So the guys that stayed mentally fresh for me, and what, however they did that, whether it was seeing a sports psychologist, whether it was doing mental training, or however they got themselves prepared, those best players I played with were always good at just staying fresh at training camp, fresh when the season started after a month-long, you know, tough physical month in September, training camp, tough times of the season, you know, that end of January, February. They always found a way to mentally stay, you know, stay on top of their game. It was, you know, it's something I talk to a lot of young kids a lot, because I don't want to get into the mental side of, you know, what makes a player, what motivates you, what do you need to think about. That's all stuff I think you have to look at. But just one simple thing is, what makes you mentally fresh to step on the ice today? And it's something simple every player can ask themselves. And I think it's something you can address, you know, on your own. If you need some help, that's, you know, I think that's great too. But there's certain things you can do that I've seen the best players, how they get their best game out of themselves is just stay fresh. And if you're mentally drained, it's tough to play at the pro level.
Mm-hmm. What was your personal strategy for staying mentally fresh?
It's something I struggled with. I was a 24/7 guy, and that's something I wish I could have gotten away from. But I would think about what happened that day all day, right? When I left the rink. And it's one of those things where if you're a professional athlete, you have to be able to just leave your game at the rink. But it's something I wanted it so bad at times that I couldn't leave it at the rink. Or in the summertime, if I didn't train for 8 hours a day, I felt like I was losing ground on other players. And, you know, it's an advantage, but it's at a disadvantage at the same time. So
yeah.
I was never good at it, but, you know, just finding other hobbies. I picked up the guitar. That was big. And I picked up a keyboard my second year because I played a little piano as a kid. So I got into music outside. See, I think it's important to kind of find a hobby. You know, I tell guys, you know, pick up a course, online course, learn a different hobby when you're not there. You have to leave, you know, the game. You have to leave hockey at the rink when you leave at noon or one or two and just kind of relax. I think if you have a family, it can be helpful. It can help you get your mind off it for sure. Obviously, that comes with a whole new set of challenges.
Yeah.
Once you're married or you have the kids. So, but at the same time, I think it can help, you know, get away from the rink, and, you know, whether things are going good or bad, it's nice to kind of get away from that. I was never good, but yeah, I kind of realized picking up hobbies and talking to family when I can, and, you know, setting goals for yourself is good too. That way, if you have a, you know, a bad week, you can kind of, you take a look at the bigger picture and you're like, hey, this is where I want to go with my season. This is what I've done well so far. And this is what I want to kind of get to. Setting goals helps. So.
Awesome. Thank you for that insight. So one thing we touched on a little bit, but I'd love to get a little deeper into it is, so for you, throughout your professional career, you bounced a bit between the NHL and the AHL. What was this experience like for you? You know, was it maybe difficult for you to get your feet set somewhere? Like, was it always this sort of uncertainty about where you're going to be next? Like, you know, should you buy a house here? Should you not? Like what was this whole kind of experience like for you? Yeah.
Yeah, it was tough bouncing around the minors. Tough to, you know, really, you know, explain the, you know, how hard that can be. And I think I looked, I moved like 40 times, wow. You know, you brought up the house thing. So yeah, between going to the city at the start of the year and bringing my stuff home from junior to pro, it was like 40 something times where I'd actually been like transferred or moved. So yeah, it's hard. And I don't know how guys did it with families, because I had some buddies that did it and were married and they had their kids and they're in the same spot I was. And I always thought that was, you know, really hard to do just being by myself, but with a family, it would, you know, it would compound all those problems and issues with moving. And, you know, they, now you add in the kids and schools and houses. For me, it's, you know, I could stay in a hotel or I could get a little one bedroom an apartment and that's it, right? But then you know, you mix in kids and you know, a wife, and that those things that you thought were problems become a lot worse. So it was challenging, and I was lucky to have my family really close to me, and you know, very fortunate to have a close family and my parents, you know, on the phone with them almost every night, and you know, talking to my sisters and, you know, dealing with that. You know, one of my sisters that's closer of age to me, we'd be on the phone a lot, and whether it was getting sent down, you know, 2 days before Christmas and being in a hotel by myself, or, you know, being scratched for the 10th game in a row and you're in, you know, Manhattan, New York City, an awesome city, and you're going to Madison Square Gardens, but you've just been scratched 10 games in a row and haven't played for 3 weeks. And,
yeah,
you know, you can barely put on your shoes, you're so down, right? And you get into a state where, you know, nothing can go right, or you don't believe you can do anything right. And those are tough times, right? But they make you stronger, right? If you can, you go through all these tough situations, and whether it's being a professional, you know, hockey player that's up and down in the minors in the NHL, or you're an Olympic athlete that just can't seem to qualify for, you know, the last race of an Olympics, or you know, you're a figure skater that every big jump keeps falling. I mean, there's so many different tough situations and athletes go through, and whether you're an athlete or, you know, in any walk of life, it's, you know, you go through these tough situations and you think they're bad at the time. And, but all of these tough situations, any situation you go through in life, you never know if it's good or bad until much later. Mm-hmm. And, what I mean by that is you should never label anything. So, being a hockey player, you know, getting sent to the minors and going through all those tough times. And when I was in Phoenix and getting sent to San Antonio, you should never label anything something bad in your life, because you might be going through something bad, but you might look at it later on and say, well, I grew out of that situation. Mm. My character became better. I became a harder worker because you know, you might have those tough situations at the time that you would, you know, label as, God, that was the worst day of my life at the time. Mm-hmm. But you look back on it 10 years later, and you say, wow, if I didn't go through that, I wouldn't have had this, this, or this, or I wouldn't be at this point. I wouldn't have been able to grow into the person I am today. So I always warn young players and, you know, different kids I work with, either athletes or, you know, just advice and mentor kids, to say that don't ever label anything. You might be going through an awful day. You might not want to get up out of bed, but those are the days sometimes. Those bad days are sometimes your best days, but you won't know until later on in life. So try not to label things. It's very difficult to do, but
yeah,
you never know when you have a bad day. It might be awful, but the growth that you come out of that situation, it might be the best day when you look back on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. And it reminds me of this saying where it's, there's no winning and losing. There's winning and learning.
Absolutely. Yep. Great. So great
way to look at kind of idea. And obviously you also learn from your wins. So they're not mutually exclusive, but just kind of shifting your perspective and mindset and saying, okay, so right now, maybe it's not the most ideal situation, but what can I gain right now? Like, how can I put myself in a better position? So in that way, maybe I don't find myself in this kind of like uncomfortable, inopportune situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's hard. It's not easy to do.
Yeah.
It takes time. Yeah, it takes time, right? So, you know, you might have a bad situation, then you might not talk in the room. So now you're rubbing off on your teammates the wrong way. Then your coach asks you to skate and you're like, oh, I don't want to listen to my coach. You just scratch me. I'm in the worst day of my life. So I think a lot of times people compound the failures, and that's the dangerous kind of rabbit hole to go down, right? And that's where you need to take a step back and, you know, like I said, when you're going through something tough, you don't know, is this going to make me a better player? Like, are you going to fold, or are you going to stay out later in practice? Are you going to look at more, you know, game tape on your shifts and how to get better? Are you going to work harder in the summertime? Are you going to become a more mentally stronger player? Are you going to, you know, what else are you going to do? Are you going to be that bad teammate in the room, or be that bad player the coaches don't want to deal with because you sat him out for a period or a game or a week, you know? And you have to go through those things, right? You have to go through those failures, and rejection's tough, right? It's one of those things where it's tough to deal with, and you have to really separate your ego from anything, because a lot of times as an athlete, your ego almost kind of gets you there. Yeah. You know, you think you're better than you are, and you're this superpower human, and that's great. But then when it doesn't go the right way, it can almost be a fault to you, right? So you have to really not let your ego get in the way and push it that's a good way to put it. You need to push your ego to the side and in the right situation. So I can't explain any better than that.
I got
your, your ego. Yeah. Your ego gets in the way, and then a lot of bad things can happen, but you need that ego, because you got to think of yourself. If you don't think you're the best player stepping on the ice, it's tough to be one of the best in the world.
So, you know, it's funny, because it kind of ties back to what we talked a bit about earlier, where maybe you were a really good player in junior and you think you're, you know,
mm-hmm.
top dog, and then you get to the NHL and you have a reality check. It's like, whoa, like, everybody here at one point was probably also the best player in their league at some point in their life.
Yeah, so
it's
absolutely I think a lot of players, it's been kind of easy for you your whole life, and you dominate in the junior level, then you take that big step up and it's like, well, okay, now you're not the best player, so now what? You're not getting the 22 minutes a night, now you're getting 12 minutes a night, now you're not in the power play. Well, I was on the power play 2 minutes every time in junior, so you have to deal with all those things. Mm-hmm. And some players just, they can't figure it out, you know. I do think it's tough for guys to figure out, and then you get to pro and then you see it, and then it's hard, right? You're not getting the same amount of ice time, and then I think it almost changes to, I think a lot of athletes actually don't believe they can become full-time pros. They can't play at that NHL level, or you know, whether you're a baseball player. I think you get into the AAA, the minor leagues, and it's almost like if you don't make it right away and you have all these hardships, I think a lot of players don't actually believe they can become a regular at the pro level. And it's funny, I had this conversation with I had an interview with an NHL team, and I was trying to explain this, and I don't think they agreed with me, but I've seen it myself in the minor leagues, right, where you play with these great players, but and you see them go up to the NHL, and it's like their game is lost. They can't seem to stick, and I really think it's deep down, either a player just gets beat down so much they're scared to go back to the AHL, and they play scared at that level. And that, I don't mean scared as in not being physical. I just mean scared to make a mistake, scared to look at it. And when you play like that or you live your life that way, it's really difficult to be successful, right?
Yeah, well, that's...
I think that's one...
Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I think that's one area a lot of players fall into, that they fall into that spot. I also think that... I think some players just, you know, they may have dreamt of being an NHL player, but I don't think they actually ever thought it would happen or it'll ever be real. It's tough when you actually get there. I think I fell into that a little bit where, you went to junior, you went to the OHL, and you're like, man, I've dreamt about playing in the NHL since, you know, whatever, the age of 14, and scouts started to come in around, and I talked about it as a kid, but to actually be there and be a regular, I think a lot of players aren't prepared for that moment. And you don't get many of them, right? Mm-hmm. You might get that chance, your first team, a team I tried for you the second time, but you know, by the age of 23, 24, a lot of teams have given up on players. So
yeah,
if you don't have everything ready and your game isn't sharp and you don't mentally think you can be there, a lot of times it will pass players. And I've seen that happen to a lot of players, and most of the time they don't even know what's happening to them.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a few things that I think you said that are really, really important. Not that the other ones aren't important, but you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So one being the idea of being afraid to make mistakes and playing in fear. Cause like you said, it's not that you're not scared of, you know, not physically, but it's like, you don't want to make a mistake. And that falls back onto the comfort zone conversation we had earlier. So if you want to grow, you have to be willing and accepting the fact that mistakes may happen.
Yeah.
But I think a big piece there now is trying to predict and thinking of what potential adversities could happen. And if they do happen, which is inevitable because they happen to all of us, how are you going to respond in the moment? So that way you're not as thrown off if it actually were to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a tough pattern to break, because I've gone through many, many times where it's, I just know, it's like almost better if you don't know. Like I've had some friends that they go up to the NHL and I'm like watching a TV. I'm like, oh, if he gives the puck away like that again, or he tries to make that move, he's in the minors again with me. And I'm watching a buddy play, and he made the same play again. High risk, but it worked out. And I was like, if that play doesn't go through, he's not going back to that team the rest of the year. I can guarantee it. But he was just a guy I grew up with that I don't think he ever realized when he was in a bad position. It could kind of help him out a little bit. I think players that are in tune with what's going on with their game and their coach and their organization, where
you know when
if you make, I could tell you times where I was like, next mistake I make, I'm out of here.
Mm.
I lose a draw, I'm out of here. And I could feel it. And I think some players just don't know. And I've had friends that they never knew. They really didn't. They just oblivious to that. You know, they're so oblivious to where they were in their situation. I think it helped them out.
For the most part.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? I don't actually believe that. I don't believe ignorance is bliss. I want the most information. I want to know everything. But in a situation like this, it can help you out at times.
Oh, it's funny when you think about it that way. So Mike, I really appreciate you taking the time today to come on the podcast. Before we wrap up, I would love to talk to you a bit about the charitable organizations you're a part of. I know you're with Baycrest, Hockey Helps mm-hmm. Homeless, and I believe there's another one as well. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that and how maybe people can check them out?
Yeah, absolutely. The Bakehurst Foundation. So it's a hospital research and care facility in Toronto, and they work with people with dementia and Alzheimer's and long-term care. And there's the Bakehurst Foundation. So just helping them raise money for all these different parts of the facility. And like I said, a lot of it goes into the care and research and trying to learn more about dementia and aging on the brain. And they do an amazing job there. And if you ever have a chance, go and check them out one day, because the operation they do have and the amount of resources and what they've developed, different technologies and the way they are caring for the aging population is extraordinary. And it's incredible the work they're doing there. So very happy to help out with them. And one of the board members on, or pardon me, committee members on the board for the Scotiabank Pro-Am. So it's just a tournament we play every year. It's like three days. You have a draft party, and it's a lot of fun. We didn't have it this year, but because of COVID, but hopefully next year we do get to put it on. So I get to help a little bit with that and other different events. And I did the 100-kilometer bike ride, Fabricland sponsored for the Bakehurst. So yeah. And thank everyone that, you know, donated money. So Bakehurst is one. 360 Kids is something else I was involved in a lot, and I haven't had much time obviously with COVID, but they do an event every year where we sleep outside and do a whole experience, we call it, right? So you go through a 360 Kids experience where they give us a sleeping bag, they give us a couple dollars, and we have to survive the night from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. out on the streets. And 360 Kids is for youth homelessness in the York region area. So everyone just thinks that youth homelessness is an issue in Toronto, but it's a really big problem outside the city and surrounding communities. And they do a great job there. They have the Hub Center in Richmond Hill, where they have day programs and meals if you just want to go in for an hour or two, and different activities if you want to do it. They have a gym there. They have different activities, a pool table. So if you need somewhere just to hang out, they have that. If you need somewhere to spend the night, they have available rooms where you can go in. And they have transition centers where you spend part of your time in an apartment condo, part of the time on your own. And they really do make a difference in York region. And they do a lot of good things for youth homelessness, because it's around us more than we think. And these youth, they're actually going to school a lot still. So there are kids that are living on the streets, but still going into class. And it's hard to fathom that actually does happen in Toronto and around the GTA. So they are, you know, they have all these great programs that are helping youth, and, you know, they need our help. And I try to make myself available to them whenever I can. And you also mentioned Hockey Helps the Homeless, and that's just one day events where we go in and play with different teams that raise money for the different communities across Canada. And the money goes right to those cities. So if we do an event in London, it goes there. If it's in Edmonton, it goes there. It's not something where they hold all the money and decide where it goes. It goes to the communities where those. So it's Hockey Helps the Homeless is, another great charity foundation that raises money for, you know, something that, you know, it's something we need to talk about. And I'm happy that, you know, the amount of money they've raised and the lives they've changed, and you get to hear stories from people that have completely, they've changed their lives. So it's a great group of people there at Hockey Helps the Homeless, and, you know, hopefully we'll be able to put tournaments on again soon.
Yeah, no, 100%. Well, Mike, again, I really, really appreciate you sharing and, you know, talking about your story and some of your perspectives and, you know, raising awareness, even was for just a couple of minutes at the end around these amazing initiatives you're a part of. So thank you for joining the podcast.
Thanks a lot for having me.
No problem. What a conversation. Wow. I really, really enjoyed that one. Another special thank you to Mike for joining the Mental Dive podcast for episode 41. And as always, everybody, please do check me out on social, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Taylor Staden, TayLor, STADEN. As well, if my podcast has brought you any sort of value and really it's just helped you in some sense, or you've just enjoyed it, I really appreciate it if you could leave me a review on Apple Podcasts. That would mean a lot to me. Well, everyone, have a fantastic rest of your day, and I'm looking forward to sharing another episode with you soon. Until next time.